It's April 27th, 2006, and we are the Image Doctors at Nikonians Podcasts. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker. And no, we're not receiving Olympic medals, although you might think so after that opening music.
We deserve them.
I doubt it.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Anyhow, we've got a wonderful show again for you today. Hopefully we will keep you all interested. Thanks again for listening. Our show today is brought to you by the Nikonians Photo Pro Shop, www.photoproshop.com. And I want to let everybody know that we've been getting a lot of questions about from those of you who saw our T-shirts on display at our PMA booth.
Or saw images online.
In the blog. We will be selling those T-shirts for $14.95 U.S. starting within the next week or so. Look for the advertisements in the forums. You'll start to see banners there shortly. And at that time, you can order these on a first-come, first-served basis. They'll be in our shop worldwide.
Yep, they should be very popular based on what we saw at PMA.
Yes, very nice 100% cotton T-shirts, yep. High-quality silk screen.
Yep, cool stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, today we're going to start our show with a topic that was suggested to us by Steve Wetzel from Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Steve. Thanks for emailing us. And Steve wanted to know a little bit more about exposure, how to judge exposure, and more specifically, Steve wanted to know about the matrix metering functions, when to use it, when not to use it. So what we thought we'd do is we'd spend some time actually talking about exposure in general.
And then right after that, our next topic, and the one that we'll use to close the podcast, will be another look at a raw converter. In this case, we'll look at raw shooter, premium, and essentials.
That's right.
So those will be our two primary topics. Cool. So let's go back to exposure.
Let's talk about exposure. Why don't you get us started, Rick, with a good primer of exposure.
A history lesson.
History lesson and basically how a light meter works, because that's really all this is about.
Yeah. And what we'll start with is center-weighted metering, and that's what used to be used on all Nikon cameras starting back in the 60s. And the whole idea there is it just meters in off the center of the image, focuses on what's in the middle of the viewfinder. And the way that light meters work in general is that they are set up to produce good results with something that's a medium tonality. You'll hear medium gray sometimes.
It doesn't have to be gray.
No, it doesn't at all. In fact, green grass is
that was the one I learned
medium
on.
Tonality, right. Pavement on roads is usually right around that same point. That is kind of gray in general. But really, it's just a good medium setting. And if you're taking photos of most people, when you include their clothes and a little bit of background stuff, they usually turn out to be pretty much medium
the
tonality.
The average
too.
Value.
And so what center-weighted metering did was, if you did have something that was medium tonality and you pointed the camera at it so that the subject was in the middle of the viewfinder, you'd get a good exposure.
Right.
And it worked pretty well for most images, and it was a very popular metering pattern. Lots of cameras ended up going to it, although I think Nikon was about the first to introduce it. The issues with center-weighted metering, first of all, what if your subject isn't in the center and something really bright is or something really dark? Then what it would try to do is make that gray. And that's the way of thinking about center-weighted meters. Whatever you point it at, it tries to make that gray or neutral tone thing. So if it's in reality white or black, it's going to come out gray.
So you get a gray picture of a black cat if that was filling the frame, or you'd get a nice picture of a gray field of snow if that was the majority of the frame, because the meter was telling the camera to do exactly what it was designed to do, which was render that scene a neutral tone gray.
Right. And most of the time it was okay, but for those subjects it was very bad.
So those of us who learned to use center-weighted meters would learn that to judge the tonality of a scene and apply compensation by either, usually with the old manual cameras, it was by opening, deliberately overexposing the scene or underexposing the scene from what the metered value would tell you. So if I knew I had, let's say, that black cat, I would stop down a little bit or increase the shutter speed a little bit to make that cat more black.
Right.
The question was, is how much should you do it?
Right. And part and of on the opposite on the film, side right? is if you were shooting snow, you would actually open up. It seemed weird to people that when you're shooting a really bright light, really light subject, you had to open up and let even more light in, but that's what you had to do so Indeed. That it didn't turn out gray. Now, the general tips were if it was white, open up about 2 stops. If it was black, stop down about 2 stops. If it was just kind of a lighter than neutral subject, maybe a light yellow or something like that. The palm of your hand, open up a stop. And if it was just kind of a dark gray or maybe a dark red or something like that, dark blue, then stop down about a stop.
And this was all real simple to do before mm-hmm. we had aperture priority. When most cameras were used, the metering was manual metering mode, manual exposure mode, I should say. So you had to set the f-stop and the shutter speed by yourself. Mm-hmm. And you used the needle meter or whatever was in the camera as a guide. To do that, and it was no big deal because you were manually setting the meter. So what you were pointing at was the meter, was what you were metering off of. And you know, you'd a lot of times see people meter off a gray card. They would point the camera at a card that was a neutral tone gray, deliberately designed to give you that reading. Mm-hmm. And then you'd make that exposure reading, set the camera to whatever, and then figure your scene's going to be okay based on that.
Yeah. Now there were a few cameras that in that same general time frame used a different kind of pattern. Not many of them really, but a few did. And sometimes it was called a zone metering pattern if it was an area that was just tighter than center weighted and within a fairly well-defined area, or if it was a really small area, a spot metering mm-hmm. pattern. And the zone is mostly gone now. It wasn't a bad metering pattern, but it's mostly gone from newer cameras, but spot metering has shown up in a lot of places.
Right.
And most newer Nikon cameras have it as an option.
Now, my grandmother had an Olympus OM4.
Right.
Actually, she had all of the Olympus cameras because they were smaller. She would have bought a Nikon, but that's another story. But they were smaller for and
Went
more
down
comfortable
that wayward
for,
path.
Yeah, it was I can't complain. My dad suggested she buy the Olympus. Yeah. So, that was at the time. But the OM4 had that multiple spot averaging function that mm-hmm. was pretty cool. You could lock in several different spots and then have the light meter average the scene for you, mm-hmm. Which was neat. And we haven't seen that return anyway in anybody of the modern cameras, at least.
Yeah, most of the people I knew that had OM4s tended to do more of what we were just talking about with a center weighted meter. Mm-hmm. They pointed at one thing that was neutral toned or they'd find some other thing and then offset it. So, my experience was that not too many people really used that feature of...
But it was neat.
Yeah, it was cool.
I just thought I would bring up a little history, a little
cool,
nostalgia.
But I think there's a reason it died off.
Yeah.
But the neat thing about spot metering is that you can take a very small, very well-defined part of the image and get a very exacting meter reading. You have to know what you're doing.
Right.
You absolutely have to be able to recognize all those tonalities because there's less slop, less room mm-hmm. for error than with a center-weighted meter.
Yeah, and if you do use spot, I would recommend using it along with your manual exposure mode mm-hmm. on whether it's a D50 or a D70 mm-hmm. or a D2X. I would recommend or a film, even a fancy F6 or something. Use that because it's if you recompose the shot, the metering value will change. Mm-hmm. So you either have to use the AE lock button on your camera, or you have to use manual exposure. The neat thing about the Nikon cameras, the wonderful thing about these, is that the newer cameras that have multiple user-selectable focus areas links the spot meter to the focus area zone.
Right.
So you can, without recomposing a picture, you could take a spot reading off of different areas of the image without having to move the composition around.
And that's really important if you're on a tripod.
Exactly.
It makes it a lot handier because otherwise it's frankly kind of awkward.
Mm-hmm. And it's a really nice feature. Someday maybe other manufacturers will do that too. But for right now, that's a good feature of your Nikon camera.
Now let's talk a little bit about the other pattern, then we'll wrap up with when you should use these patterns, because that's really the important question, when to use each type.
So that brings us to the fancy, latest and greatest computer-assisted metering system, which is matrix metering,
mm-hmm.
or 3D matrix metering, or sometimes called evaluative metering.
Right. but not by Nikon.
But not by Nikon. Yeah. We call it matrix metering over in this camp.
Yep. And Nikon was actually the first to introduce it. They introduced it in a manual focus camera called the FA, which came out in, I think, like 83 or something like that, somewhere around that time frame, maybe 84. And the idea is it takes the scene and then breaks it up into different segments and then looks at each of those segments in comparison with each other. For example, it'll look at the top area, and if it's, you know, brighter than the bottom area of the image, it might conclude that you're shooting something that's kind of like a landscape with a bright sky. And it will typically open up a little bit to get a little bit more shadow detail in the foreground, mm-hmm. because center-weighted meters would usually underexpose the foreground. They would just have problems
because they would
with
be getting a lot of the reading off the sky, and so
right. And there, that. Then there are other analogous situations where maybe, you know, one side of the image is a little bit darker than the other side, and it might conclude that you've got a subject that's in shadows or something like that, and also open up a little bit.
Right.
In general, it'll have a tendency to open up the exposure, make it a little bit brighter. Sometimes it will do the other, but more often than not. Mm-hmm. It'll actually increase the amount of exposure.
Now, with the autofocus cameras and the multiple segment or the multiple area autofocus, you link the matrix meter to the autofocus sensor. Mm-hmm. So it'll tend to disregard things that may be not the subject. I mean, obviously, if you're focusing on something, the camera's going to think that that might be the subject of interest. Mm-hmm. And if it's a little darker or a little brighter, it would make adjustments to the exposure, the meter value, based on that, and potentially disregard something either very bright or very dark in some other part of the frame. Mm-hmm. So if you had a picture of, and there was a white piece of paper in the center of the frame, but you were focusing on the lower left corner of the frame, that piece of white paper wouldn't be rendered gray. It would be rendered white because it would be disregarded from the equation, so to speak,
right.
in theory.
Right.
This now, is always in theory.
Right. Now, more recent versions of the matrix metering pattern have also included distance information. Now, that's primarily with flash calculations, although it does enter with some other things, too. If the focus is very distant, like at infinity, it'll make some slight adjustments, but it's mainly with the flash metering stuff. The other recent change is the introduction of color into it, and that's not a huge factor, but it will change the exposure a little bit. You know, a good example is yellows. If it sees something that's a yellow, it'll often open up just a tiny bit, give mm-hmm. a little bit more exposure.
And that was introduced with the F5 camera.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one of the healthiest debates from 5 years ago, before everyone was making the switch to digital, was do I buy an F5 or an F100? And one of the features of the F5 had that the F100 did not was RGB or color matrix metering.
Right.
And I saw a lot of comparison shots, and the differences were there, but they were very subtle.
Yeah, it was one of those things where it went from being correct, you know, maybe 95% of the time to 96%. So not a huge difference, but you could see it.
It could make you
times.
Feel better when you yeah. spent the money on it.
Yeah.
Though.
That's important. So the color thing was an introduction. Now,
when should you use these modes?
Well, let's talk about one other thing first, because there's one important thing. The difference between black and gray and white really cannot be discerned by matrix meters. Now, there actually are some situations where it works well for whites. Like if you're out in bright sunlight and shooting snow, it will actually generally expose that correctly, but it's not because it knows that it's white per se versus black or gray. It has to do with the brightness level. And mm-hmm. matrix meters will cap themselves at a certain point. It's the equivalent of bright sunlight on sand, you know, like at a beach, or snow. Anything brighter than that, it assumes that there's just something strange going on.
Like a specular.
Yeah, specular highlight, something like that. And it won't give the image any more exposure. So if you're out in that situation, things actually turn out white because of that cap. Now, the same exact image, sand or snow under overcast lighting, it will turn out gray. Mm-hmm. It won't be white anymore, and that's because the meters really can't tell the difference between a white, a gray, and a black subject.
Right. So, and none of them do. I mean, they
no, none of them do. I mean, it doesn't
because
matter
it's,
the brand.
It's very subjective, and it depends on, you know, it's a perception thing, and it depends on the ambient lighting.
Right.
So
the key thing is if you're in one of those situations with sand or snow, and it's bright outside, your matrix meter will probably give you a good reading. If it's overcast, you're
going
to have to open it up or maybe switch to one of the other patterns.
Right. Now, the way I usually, before we switch to the other topics, mm-hmm. but the way I usually do this in the field when I'm using matrix metering, because that is, for wildlife photography that I do, 99%
of
the time.
It's a great pattern.
I don't have to screw around with it. I can set it on that, and I know that most of the time, the exposure will be dead on.
Yeah, I don't like it as much for a lot of landscape stuff, mm-hmm. especially if it's
right.
early morning and a really dramatic lighting. I'll usually use spot, at least with film cameras.
Right. My traditional settings are aperture priority exposure mode and matrix metering. And then what I'll do is dial in a little bit of plus or minus exposure compensation on the camera body itself. Mm-hmm. And usually I do this, and this is where, for the subjects that I shoot, this is where matrix sometimes gets fooled, is a lot of times I will have a subject that's fairly small compared to the overall scene. Therefore, I want to expose for that subject a little bit better. The best example I've ever had that I can come up with in a tricky exposure situation is something like an American coot, which is a black bird with a very light gray, almost white duck bill. You will blow out that duck bill every time because the matrix meter said, hey, that's bright. It's a very small portion of the scene. Disregard it entirely. Let it be white. It's okay.
And it sees that black thing and tries to open up.
Right. And it's not doing anything wrong. That's just how it works. So I'll usually put in minus one-third to minus two-thirds. Mm-hmm. And if I want it a little lighter, I'll put in plus a third to plus mm-hmm. plus two-thirds. And that's usually I don't ever go more than two-thirds of a stop. Rarely have I ever gone plus an entire stop when I'm using matrix metering. Now, that wouldn't be the case for those other situations. So when would you want to use something other than matrix metering? And you kind of answered the question yourself, Steve, when you asked us this question, is you were shooting some backlit silhouette type of shots where your subject that you're focusing on is you want it to be black. You want it to be a silhouette. Now, there's a case where, or you're taking a picture of a sunset, there's a case where you don't want a neutral tone necessarily.
Yeah. Center weighted works pretty well for that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so how would you do that? You would take the meter reading, decide whether or not first of all, you have to decide which metering pattern to use. If you've got a large scene that's over, generally you can decide its tonality value. You look at it and say, there's not a lot of variation in this scene, like a sunset. You know, there's going to be some bright parts, there's going to be some dark parts, but overall, it's not too bad. You can meter off of that and just let it be neutral, and that might work just fine. Or decide, hey, you know what, this is mostly going to be a little bit lighter. I want to open up a stop.
The key thing is to kind of swing the camera, if you can move it, if it's not locked down mm-hmm. on a tripod, to an area that's, you know, not the brightest part of the image and not the darkest. It's that in-between thing, which is that mm-hmm. medium tonality. And then, you know, set your exposure off of that, and then you'll get a good image right. for that situation.
And for the film shooters out there, you guys know what we're talking about. It's called bracketing. You used to do this all the time. You don't have the luxury of checking an exposure histogram. So you take a series of shots, one with the metered value, and then a series over or underexposed, depending on what you think, in different f-stop increments. Sometimes you would do a series of plus two-thirds or minus two-thirds. Or more, plus a stop, minus a stop, depending on the kind of film you're using, just because each film has a different latitude and a different exposure tonality range right. that it can capture.
Now, digital is a bit different than film.
Right.
You know, you really
yeah,
do
no
meter.
Film.
Yeah, there's no film. But the you do meter a bit differently, and I found over time I'm not doing the same things I used to do with slide film, which is what I used to use for the most part. one of the big differences is that with a digital camera, you can see how the image came out. You can check the histogram right after you shot the first image and make some adjustments if it's a little bit off. Mm-hmm. And what you're really trying to do with a digital shot isn't necessarily always getting a medium tonality to be medium. There's also an argument for not skewing things too far over to the left on the histogram, because then if you try to boost up the exposure a little bit in Photoshop, you'll get a lot of noise. And in fact, you know, if you're going to err, you want to err on the side of having things a little bit over the right without blowing out the highlights.
There's always the catch, right?
Right. You don't want to blow out the highlights, but if you can keep them shifted over the right, you'll get a little bit less noise in your image.
Right.
And that's a good thing.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of a difference between digital and film right there. I find myself using Matrix a lot more with digital than I did with film. I was a big spot metering fan with film. And the reason is just because I can check the histogram.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, last show we talked a little bit about the photography we did down in southern Texas on the birds. And one of the things that we were both doing at times is dialing in -1/3 or -2/3 exposure compensation. That was because we had birds that were kind of like just what you were mentioning.
Right.
They were a little bit different.
The
caracaras
were a good
example.
Of that. Dark bird with a light head. So.
Exactly. And if we just shot straight matrix metering, there was a bit of a chance of blowing out some of the whites. It just depends on how large of area they are in the frame.
Right. The farther away they get, the smaller the white parts are relative in the frame,
right,
the more likely matrix is to blow those out.
Right. But the good thing is you can dial in just a little bit of underexposure there, depending on how small the image is in the frame,
mm-hmm,
and then still let it go. And, you know, if the light changes a little bit, you'll still get a good exposure.
And so in general, my camera is left on matrix metering,
mm-hmm,
but then those other times where I'll go and I'll switch to something like spot where I know I want to really hit it right.
Right. Now, one final little nuance, and this is a digital kind of thing. Earlier, we were talking about the +2 stops being great for reproducing white, and that was true on slide film. With digital, it's got a little bit more headroom than most slide film. And so if you shoot with a spot metering pattern on something that's a white subject,
and you want it to be white with a little detail.
It's a little bit more than 2 stops. And you can always fiddle with that in Photoshop. But just realize if you did just a straight 2 stops, you'll actually get something that's a little bit grayish.
Just a teeny bit.
Just a teeny bit grayish.
But you can see it and just try it, you know. And
white's really about 2.5.
Yeah.
With most of the digital cameras I've used.
The beauty of all these things, though, for those of you who are shooting digital, is if you want to really learn how your spot meter works and your light meter works, boy, it's so great to be able to experiment with
that. Really
so get
easy.
Out there, play it, take meter readings off of different things. Just take a white piece of paper, see what you have mm-hmm. to do to make it white using your spot meter. It's easy to do. It doesn't cost you any film. And
now, here's the final thing that we'll talk about, because we don't want to completely emphasize digital. Let's talk about print film. Print film's a different animal.
It is.
It's not like slide film, and it's not like digital, because those two are kind of similar in a lot of respects.
I didn't shoot a lot of print film.
Yeah, with print film, I'll tell you, it almost doesn't matter what metering pattern you use too much, whether it's center weighted or the matrix.
Seems like the lab boys can always fix your print film.
Well, they can. It's got huge latitude on the overexposure side. You could shoot something dead on, it would look good, +1... stop overexposure, it'll still look great on the print. 2 stops overexposure, still look great. Guess what? At 3 stops overexposure, it still looks very good. If you looked at the prints, they wouldn't look very different at all. Now, when you start underexposing the images,
that's forgiveness for you.
Oh, it's incredibly forgiving. On the underexposure side, it's a little bit more sensitive. You know, minus a stop, it's still okay. -2 stops, you'll start seeing lots of grain, and it just won't look good,
right,
and the saturation level drops down. So what's the moral on all of that? If you're going to err with print film, err on the side of overexposing a little bit. And frankly, you could take a center-weighted metering pattern and put it on +1 and just kind of shoot away to your heart's content. You'll get great-looking prints, probably. You could guess, too, and you'll get great-looking prints. You know, you could just use F-16 rule or the little information that comes with film, and you'll get great shots with print film. It almost doesn't matter by comparison with the others. It's so incredibly forgiving. And if you see exposure errors most of the time, it's because your photo processor that you're using is not a good quality one. It's usually the printing process where
they're making a lot of adjustments that you don't even see behind the scenes.
Yeah, exactly.
That's another subject for another day.
Yep. So hopefully that helps, Steve.
Let's hope so. Yep. And thanks again, of course, for emailing us. And if you have a question or you'd like to suggest a show topic, please do so. talkradio@nikonians.org. Mm-hmm. So we have a little bit of time to talk about RAW Shooter, a RAW converter. It's available in two versions. RAW Shooter Essentials, which has the best price of them all. It's free.
Yep.
And
can't
it doesn't expire, right?
Nope, doesn't
expire.
And
then a RAW Shooter Premium version, which has more features than the Essentials version, and it costs $89.95.
In the U.S.
In the United States. And these are both available from a website called Pixmantic.com, and we'll put the link in the Nikonians show notes on the podcast page, and we'll also put it in the podcast forums. If you haven't been checking out the podcast forums, let me remind you, we have a forum set up just for podcast feedback, so don't forget to go over there too.
Yeah.
So, Rick, this is a Windows program.
Yeah, that's the one downside, right.
And I'm a Mac guy, so I actually will be honest, I haven't used the program. So I'm going to sort of turn things over to you. I know we've discussed it a little bit here this afternoon, and we've looked at what it does, and I've taken a look at it. It looks pretty good to me, actually.
Yeah.
But I'll let you talk about sort of the basics of it here.
Sure. Originally, they introduced the Essentials program, which, as you were mentioning earlier, was free. And, you know, that was to get people interested in the product and try it out. And I tried it out at that point, not too long after it was first
introduced.
It
was about a year and a half ago, right?
Something like that. It's been out for a while. Mm-hmm. And
I remember when
even
it came
in the
out.
Early versions, it was pretty good. I was actually quite impressed with it. It was lacking some features found in other RAW converters, but that's kind of to be expected for, one, a free product, and two, something that was, you know, in the very early stages. But there were some things about it I liked in terms of workflow, the sharpening stuff. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. Since that time, they've continued making improvements to the free converter and adding more camera bodies to it in terms of compatibility.
Right, so this will work with pretty much any...
A lot digit, of them.
Or most of the
a
major,
lot of them.
Not just Nikon.
No, it'll work with other brands too. They do have some limitations in terms of the older Nikon digital bodies, like the D1 series, D1X, D1H, D1. It won't work with those files right now, and I wouldn't expect them to add it either, but you know, who knows. But it will work with a number of other brands. So if you're working with multiple brands of DSLRs, it can be a nice thing to have a common RAW converter, same advantage that Bibble had that we talked about a month ago. In general, what I would say is it's got very nice workflow, very modern workflow. It's just like with Bibble, it's very easy to copy conversion settings from one file to another.
Yeah,
do batch processing, very cool. I would say fairly equivalent on that front. And so if workflow is something that you value a lot, if you're going to be processing a whole bunch of RAW images, it's not something I normally do. But if you are doing that, it's a good choice for a RAW converter. Some other things.
How does it work with, do you need a lot of horsepower system requirement wise?
No, it's pretty good in that
pretty
respect.
Good idea. You know, you don't need the 3 gigabytes of RAM or whatever, you know, to run it.
No, for example, I've got, as you know, a very weak and underpowered laptop.
It's puny.
It's a 600 megahertz Pentium thing that's years old. The memory's maxed out at 512 meg, so you're not very powerful. I can run it fine.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's good to know. I mean, not everybody is going to run out and buy a brand new computer just to convert their RAW files.
Yeah, it works pretty well on that. General features are you know, a lot like what you'll find in other RAW converters. You can do let's talk a little bit about the differences first, I guess, between the free one and the premium, and then we'll talk a little bit more about
Right. I mean, what you're going to see, people, features. I mean, one thing that's sort of evident, I mean, we've been playing around with all these raw converters, and I'll just say that, you know, to not sound like a broken record, they will all do more or less the same thing
basic
in terms
things.
Of controls. I mean, some of the, what we're going to hopefully, you know, you're going to be able to adjust color and contrast and
exposure.
Sharpening and exposure and do the things, white balance, all of those things that you would expect from a raw converter. If they don't have those features, we won't recommend it because it wouldn't be
they
a
all
good
have
raw
them,
converter.
Though.
But they all have them. That's
so
right.
It makes so, it easy.
But what we like to say is, you know, what are the sort of the strengths of each one of these? And, you know, and of course, we're limiting our discussion to how well it converts the Nikon RAW files, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So the free version is lacking some things found in the premium one. You can't crop images within the RAW converter. You mm-hmm. could always do it later in Photoshop. It doesn't have a curves or levels function, at least not a traditional levels function,
right, you were saying
like
that.
You find in the premium version and most other converters. So that, you know, that's a
it has some ways that you can adjust that, sort of, right?
Yeah, you okay. can. There's
but it's just
sliders.
Not your you wouldn't have your traditional levels
right.
tool or curves tool
sliding around the little diamonds.
Right, if you're used to that, then that's not going to be there.
Right. There, the premium version has a magnifier feature, which is kind of cool, where you can. You know, move your cursor around the images and see a image and see a.
You know, Rick, when you move your hands around like that, nobody can see
I
you
know,
talking
but,
with your hands here.
But it
this
would look
radio.
Great if they could see it. It's hard not talking with my hands. So it doesn't have that magnifier feature. And it's also missing a few other settings. There's a thing in the premium version called vibrance, which is a little bit like saturation, but not quite. Think of it as giving the image more of a Velvia look.
Okay.
And that's a slider in the. That's in the premium version, not found in the essentials. The color balance and noise suppression features found in the premium one aren't there. But, you know, the basic things are there, and it's got good workflow. That stuff works.
And, I mean, if you want to try this out, I mean, it is free.
Yeah, gosh. Yeah, and if you're not shooting a whole lot of raw images, gosh, you know, it's hard to argue with free, and it does a good job. Now, in general, what I like about these two converters. One, the quality of conversions with both of them is good. It produces fairly natural-looking images. The color is nice, things of that sort.
Do you see any artifacts?
Nothing substantial.
Demosaicing artifacts?
Yeah. Where I see that the most is with ACR.
We'll talk about ACR.
And this one is better in that front. We already talked about workflow and everything. It's excellent on that front, and you can have images processing in the background mm-hmm. while you're continuing to work on those things. That's always limited by how much horsepower you have, but it'll do that. The sharpening is really interesting on the RAW shooter, RAW processors, both of them. And the default setting will yield an awful lot of detail in your final image. In fact, the first time I started using it, I was really surprised at how much detail it was extracting from what were at the time D2H images. It was just like, wow, this is unbelievable.
And remember, Nikon's default sharpening settings are usually fairly conservative, you should say.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to always need to sharpen a little bit to begin with on
if
any
If you're
RAW
using
file.
The in-camera kind of
Especially,
settings.
Yeah, the in-camera settings.
Yeah, that really only applies with capture.
Mm-hmm.
But I was amazed at how much detail I was able to get out of the image. And it is doing some clever things there. Now, since then, I figured out how to do that in Capture, and it has to do with using the Uncharted mask settings, USM, which do some very clever things
now, you
also.
You were saying that the RAW Shooter Essentials most likely or does sharpen only in the luminosity
That's
channel.
Just a guess okay. based on the way
so,
the results look.
So that means you're
you halos can, are not
halos are
problem.
Not a problem. That's right.
Yeah, and the results look very natural.
Excellent.
Yeah, very nice.
Well, that's very cool.
Yeah, so I think it does an exceptionally good job extracting detail. Like I said, you know, in a later episode, we'll talk about how to do that with Capture, too.
Sure.
But definitely a superior job there.
It might be for a while before we talk about the next version of Capture.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. The price, you can't beat free for the
right.
Essentials version. But the price for the premium one is a good one, too.
Yeah, $89.95.
Yeah, that's pretty reasonable in terms of RAW converters.
That seems to be about the market rate.
Yeah. Now, on the downside of it, I find the images a little bit on the flat side, even when I jack up the vibrance and some other things. They're just a little bit flat, and that obviously is a taste thing, but I would say I have a little bit harder time getting quite the look I like, but it's still good. You know, very few people would complain. It's just when I do a side-by-side comparison, they look a little bit flatter to me. We've already talked about the fact that it's Windows only.
Right, so there's
right
Mac people like me, we just have to pay our dues and
right.
wait.
Yeah, it doesn't work as a plug-in or anything like that with Photoshop like Bibble does or like ACR does. I don't find that to be a big deal, but if you want that, that's not something it does.
So it runs as a standalone right. application only.
Right. Noise reduction is a manual thing, like with Bibble.
Uh-huh.
And so you have to adjust that yourself or use presets that you create as opposed to, you know, the more automated forms that are found in some other raw converters. Let's see. The last con is it doesn't have any highlight recovery.
Okay.
And some do. Bibble does. Capture does. What else?
I think so.
ACR does.
Certainly does. And I think a lot of them try to do something.
A lot of them are starting to introduce it. I wouldn't be surprised if at some point this podcast is wrong on that front and that feature is added to it. But right now it doesn't have highlight recovery. So if you overexpose slightly and you have some slightly blown out highlights, you know, like a half stop or whatever, some of the others will allow you to recover that and get good looking results. With this one, it will not do that. Not a huge thing.
And as we mentioned, it doesn't support the D1 series. Nikons.
Right. So yeah. Right.
That was sort of the last thing.
So in terms of target market
for this. Yeah, who would be best? I mean,
if you're not shooting a whole lot of raw stuff and you don't have Photoshop with ACR in it.
Yeah, let's say you have an earlier version of Photoshop.
Yeah, a free raw converter is hard to argue with.
Right.
And Essentials is a good raw converter.
But the person who would be using this program, you're going to, I mean, especially if you're using the free one, you're going to want to have some form of Photoshop or Photoshop Essential Elements or something like that to further refine your image. Is that right?
Right. Now, also, I think... Never mind the free aspect, because there's one that they charge for. It's got excellent workflow. I mean, it really does. And if you use this properly, you can get some very nice-looking images, too. So someone that's shooting an awful lot of raw, you know, a lot of quantity, an event photographer, a sports photographer that's not using JPEG, it's wonderful for that. So I would highly recommend it. You know, oftentimes, people that really like RAW end up with multiple RAW converters, and this could be a nice complementary one if you're doing a lot of high-volume stuff. And
of course, you know, if you've got more than just a Nikon digital camera,
right.
This would be an advantage because you're going to be able to open up. You'd have one converter that would open up a bunch of different.
Yeah. So you wouldn't have to learn all the nuances.
Right. You could in theory have the same workflow for each camera.
Yep. So all in all, I think they're very nice products. I would certainly recommend downloading them, trying them out. No reason not to. They produce good results, and it's a very modern set of converters. Now, one last thing, we'll just add to the discussion that we had a month ago.
Add to the confusion.
Oh, sure. Why not? With all of these RAW converters, including ones that we'll talk about in future episodes, one of the most important things is that you learn it well, that you take time to really be able to dial in the converter for your own preferences, the kind of shooting that
right.
you do, how much saturation you like, how much sharpening you like, all of those kind of things. What cameras are you using? I think there are some that work a little bit better with certain brands or bodies than others. But you got to take time to do that. So with all of these, they have the potential to produce really good results, but it may take a little bit of time to figure out how to do that. That's always been the case for me.
Right.
So what becomes really important is not flitting around between, you know, a bunch of different converters, but sticking with one that has the general attributes that you like and then really learning it well.
Yeah.
And then you'll do all right. You can produce good results with all of them.
I mean, there's no one workflow that is correct.
No.
There is no one size fits all. The key to any workflow would be to know how you do it and get good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And that just takes time and practice.
Right.
And then in the future, you may streamline that workflow, but, you know, trying to use 3 or 4 different ROP converter products
will just drive you nuts, and then you won't get good images.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You'll spend more time learning.
And there truly is quite a difference between images that are produced after you've learned a converter well and the ones that you get initially. Give it some time, and you'll see what I mean. The results, or the difference in results, can be quite shocking.
So get out there and try it. I guess. Yep. Looking at the clock here, it looks like we're out of time for
yep.
this episode. Unfortunately, I know you guys all just, you know, beating yourselves over the head because of that. But we will be back in another couple of weeks with another report. We'll try to squeeze in our 200 to 400 review, I think, next time.
Yep.
But as always, if you've got a, we will always put things off if someone emails us with a better topic.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's because we have attention deficit disorder. So
what?
Huh? I don't know. I forgot.
Okay. Yeah. I have what's his name's disease. Yeah. Anyhow, until next time, thanks for listening to this broadcast of the Image Doctors on Nikonia's podcasts, and we will see you next time.
All right. Bye bye.